Again, our meeting format calls for a guest speaker followed by open discussion. Our guest speaker will speak for 30 to 45 minutes. At our speaker's discretion, we may invite questions from the audience for 10 minutes before our discussion portion of the meeting. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's chair speaker, Dave M. from Bakersfield, who just celebrated 38 years on the 10th of this month.
I'm Dan Mongi, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dan.
And I'm glad to be here. I want to thank Bill for asking me up here tonight. It's always a great pleasure to come to Visalia. It's a great city, and our business that we're in is we're in the landscape construction business and design. And every time I come to Visalia, I'm always amazed how beautiful the city is. And it takes me back to my childhood when my dad came up here many times to do different projects here in the city of Visalia. And as a matter of fact, this was his very first sweepstakes of winning award in the state of California, right here in Visalia. So there's a connection to the city that I really feel close to. And as I was coming into town this evening, I was mentioning it to my wife about how beautiful the streets were and the homes and the gardens that I see here, because I have a real appreciation for that. I didn't always have that appreciation, so we're going to talk a little bit about what it was like for me, and so I can qualify the fact that I do deserve a seat here in the rooms. But I started drinking at a really young age. I was probably, my first blackout drunk was at 9, and I was with an older cousin of mine, and was on a fine bottle of Ripple, if anybody knows. They're still making it, by the way. I happen to notice that they're still making Ripple, but I drank a lot of Ripple, and I got drunk, and I got sick, and that was part of my MO, is to get drunk, black out, and get sick. So that continued for quite a while, and as I got older, I knew that the minute I had that experience with it, is I finally felt this feeling like I fit in. I finally felt like this is what I was, what the answer was alcohol was the answer for me, and that if I had kept on going, then I could feel that way more often. And that's what I did from about 9 on. It was a little bit more difficult for me to get alcohol on a regular basis. But I was living in Los Angeles with an uncle of mine, and he was a declarated World War II veteran who was suffered from PTSD before they even knew about PTSD. And I lived with him in the city of Englewood for quite a while, about a year and a half to 2 years with my Uncle Henry. And Henry was a hard drinker. And we would go and buy a case of 10 High whiskey. And I don't know if anybody's ever drank 10 High, but it's really great bourbon. And it's cheap. And he liked cheap bourbon. That was really, that would work. And we'd buy a six-pack of Bubble Up. A lot of you are probably too young to remember what Bubble Up was like. And this was before caps. You know, we used to have this plastic cap that I'd have to put on the Bubble Up bottle every time we'd open it. And there were two things that I always had to remember when I'd ever make a drink for either one of us. Is number one is not to put too much ice in it, because that took up too much room. And number two, he didn't want me to waste any of the Bubble Up. So I'd pour a tall glass of whiskey and a couple of cubes of ice. And we used to have those old ice cube trays that you had to crack open, and they were metal, and I put a couple of cubes in, and that was fine for Henry. And we'd sit there and get drunk, I mean, just about every night. So he really taught me how to drink. He got me into my first bar. I think I was probably 13 years old the first time I got into a bar, and I started drinking. I was a bar drinker. I was able to get in and get served. I looked a lot older than I was, because I was the same height as I am today, and carried myself a little differently, and was able to get into bars and buy booze on a regular basis. So I was able to get drunk quite often, and a lot of older guys would come over to the house and actually ask me to go buy booze for them, because they couldn't I couldn't get it sold to him. So at that point, I was drinking almost every day, and I drank all the way through high school and junior high. I was drunk most of it. Some of you probably drank the same way, but I was a daily drinker. I had to get drunk every day. And once I realized that this was going to fix me, I had to have it. I mean, it wasn't a question of whether I wanted to. I had to. So I started drinking on a daily basis all the way through junior high, into high school. It was accelerated even worse. They caught me with a fifth of whiskey in my locker a couple of times. I went to Hollywood High School, and I remember getting written up for having alcohol at school. And then I figured out that if I just didn't go to school, they couldn't write me up. So I remember in my senior year, I went to the counselor there and said, well, it looks like I'll be graduating. And he just started laughing at me. You know, and I thought to myself, what's the funny? You know, I'm a senior. And he goes, hey, Monty, he said, I said, I've been coming to school for 3 years. And he says, you may have been coming to school, but you haven't been in school. I don't know where you've been, but you haven't been here. And because I hung out with the guys that did the same thing I did. I got drunk and got loaded, and that was basically all of high school. What happened to me is an experience that I had. I hung with some guys that were getting, at the time, I considered were pretty tough, and probably some of other people considered they were pretty tough. And we ended up at a bowling alley. It was called the Hollywood Bowl. It was right off of Hollywood Boulevard, if anybody's ever been down there, and they've torn it down since then. But it was a bowling alley, and we went there, and we were drunk, and there were three of us there. And I think what happened was there were some kind of verbal altercation between one of the guys that I was with. And matter of fact, I know there was more than three of us. There were five of us because we're at the bowling alley, and somehow there were words said and some blows thrown inside the bowling alley. And these two guys that ended up doing it, having the words and throwing the blows, said that they wanted us to go outside. And there's two of them and five of us. And I looked at Tyrone and I said, Tyrone, I don't think it's a good idea we go outside. And I was drunk, but I had my senses with me. Two guys don't usually call out five guys. You know, and I said, these guys, they've got to have something going for them. And I don't feel real good about going outside. And the next thing you know, we went outside. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it had moved. You know, I'm a little bit old. I'm older than a lot of you in the rooms today. But and we used to fight quite a bit through school and growing up. But I never used a gun. But this guy, one of them had a gun. And so thank God that these guys that carry them aren't very good shots, because none of us got killed that day. But I remember a bullet zinging by my head, and I don't know how many of you in the room, so maybe you guys, there's somebody here that has had that experience happen. But it changes you. It really changes you when the bullet comes that close to your head, knowing that just an inch or so more would have went right into my head. And I remember telling my friend Tyrone, I said, after that experience, I said, I'm gonna get out of L.A. I said, you know, these streets are going to kill me. And he looked at me like I was crazy, you know. He said, man, you're not going to go to Bakersfield, are you? And I said, yeah, I said, I'm going to go back home. I said, I'm out of school. I'm going to go back to Bakersfield and work for my father. Because I said, these streets are going to kill me. And he just couldn't believe it. He said, I can't believe that you're going to do that, man. You're a player. You know, you're here. And I'm glad I left. Because out of those five guys, I can tell you right now, there's three of them that are dead. And then two of them, one of them is in prison. He'll never come out. And I think Tyrone will be 87 when they let him out. So, you know, I feel pretty lucky that God was there with me that night in the bowling alley. And he was with me throughout my drinking. So as I got into drinking after coming back to Bakersfield, I decided, you know, I was going to live on my own. I was 17 years old, and my dad didn't really like me getting drunk every night and coming home drunk. And he said, you know, that you're not going to live here just getting drunk every night and going home. You got to get your ass out of here. And I did. I got my own apartment at 17. I moved out and kept on drinking. And that progressed all the way through for the longest time. I drank every day, and I ended up being, at 17, I came back, and I ended up working as a bouncer in a bar just before my 18th birthday. I was hired. I was at a bar, and it was called the Bakersfield Inn then, and it's a really nice hotel and bar and restaurant, and I happened to be in there drinking. I was a bar drinker because I learned from my uncle how to drink in the bars, and I liked the bars. So, and I was working, I had money, so I'm sitting there and I'm drinking all by myself, and there happened to be a fight on the dance floor, and this one guy pulled a knife on the other guy, and I just got up and picked up a chair. I remember that night I slammed him on the back of his neck and head with that chair. It was a banquet chair, you know. They're pretty good size and they're pretty heavy. Knocked the shit out of him, and then I picked him up, threw him out the door, and the owner happened to be there. His name was Morley Turner, and he said, have you ever bounced before? And I said, no. But he said, we're looking for a man your time to do that. He says, you know, I think it paid like $12 or $15 a night, plus you got dinner and all you could drink. It's a perfect job for an alcoholic and somebody like me. So I did that for a long time until they found out. You know, I was always really good at finding out who the guys that weren't supposed to be, that weren't 21, that was trying to get in. Because obviously I'm 18. And nobody's asking me, but I found a way to be able to work an ID change. And it worked out really well for me for a long time. That part of my story there is that I acted up actually falsifying. I made a lot of money falsifying real IDs through the DMV. And the DMV made me sign an agreement that I would never tell of the system that I was using to be able to get these IDs, because I had one. So that's how I got the job. But you come to light, and I worked there for almost 2 years when they fired me. They said, hey, you can't be doing this job. We know that you're not 21. You've got an ID that says you're 21. The DMV says you're 21, but we know you're not 21. So that was the end of that. But my drinking could progress to where I was drunk every night. I mean, it was every night, every day. I was drinking in the mornings because I couldn't go to breakfast with my dad and keep my hands steady in the morning without a couple of drinks. And I didn't find out until later on that, you know, if you drink a beer, and I had always kept beer in my fridge, if you drink a beer in the morning when you got a hangover, then it kind of settles you down. So I moved up from the whiskey to just having a beer. It was more for medicine, to go to breakfast with my dad. And he couldn't believe that my life would have to, you know, was the cycle of getting drunk over and over again. My dad never drank. And that progressed along to the point, I'm going to tell this one story because I had thrown this party every year. I never celebrated my birthday, but I threw a party every year on my birthday and never told anybody that it was my birthday. But I threw this big party, and we went and I bought several cases of hard liquor, and we got a keg of beer, and I'd usually invite a bunch of people over to this party, and we did this all before the night before the party, because you got to get your shit together before you party. So you got to get all the stuff, and I got all the stuff, and I got a couple of my buddies that were there that were helping me set up, and the next thing you know, we're popping vodka out, and I never had Stoli, you know, that had just come out, that Russian vodka, and I thought to myself, man, and I never had Stoli with lime juice, and it's called Kamikaze. And I'm Japanese, so I thought, man, I should be able to drink that stuff. And I ended up drinking that Kamikazes with these guys and doing some other things that we don't talk about in AA, but there were other things that were involved there, too. And the next thing I know is we drank the better half of 2/5 in about 35 to 40 minutes of vodka between three guys. And a lot of them weren't drinking. The other two were probably not hitting them as hard as I was because it took a lot to get me drunk. But I was, after getting drunk, I noticed the party was kind of slowing down a little bit. Ever been at a party and you've got a few friends over and it's kind of getting slow, you know? So I had a 12-gauge shotgun and a box of shells. And after you drink it, two bottles of Stoli, and we're just shooting them, one right after the other. I loaded up that 12-gauge shotgun, and I shot my television. You know, I had a component stereos in that one those days. Component stereos were big. I shot that. I shot a couple holes in, and I traumatized my dog. You know, I have a Samoyan, and he had PTSD after that experience. And another one of my buddies said, man, that looks like fun, and he started shooting. So we ended up going through that whole box of shells. You know, and maybe somebody can correct me, but I think there's like 12 rounds in a box of shotgun shells. Might be 15, but we went through the whole box. And all of a sudden, we're continuing to party, and we're having this great time. And one of the guys says, I just saw a cop. And I said, you're shitting me. He goes, no. He said, there's a cop. He just went by the window. And he says, and then the other guy, not too much later, he saw another cop. And he said, well, there's cops all over the place. And then the one guy says, I think there's one on the roof. And I thought it was because of these other things that we were doing. You know, you kind of get paranoid. And that's what I told him. I said, man, you know, you guys are just getting paranoid. We're not, there's nothing. You see, after the shotgun and the rounds are done, you see, 5 or 6 months later, a drunk never remembers shit. And I didn't remember doing any of that until the bullhorn. We look outside and it's surrounded. They have now called probably 15 police officers and cars are blocked. They blocked the street on both sides. And I heard this bullhorn come out and say, you inside the house, come out with your hands up, throw your weapons out, and come out with your hands up. I didn't know what weapons he was talking about because I didn't even remember the shotgun incident. And so, but I said, shit, I'm going to go out there and take care of this. And you can imagine, I'm drunk, but I'm going to go take care of it. I said, I'll be right back. And the thing was, is I walk outside and a gun gets put right in the side of my temple here. He was hanging out on the back of the door and he put it right on me, you know, and I could feel that muzzle sitting right next to my head. And I remember looking at this officer, and I said, please don't shoot me on the oops, you know, because he could have pulled that trigger and oops, I'd have been gone. So, right after I said that, I just fell right on my face in the sidewalk at my house. And this is August, because my birthday is the 15th of August, my belly button. And I could hear those cops saying, did you see that? He just fell right on his face. And I had a scratch here. I mean, a big bruise and scratch here. I had one on my nose and one on my forehead. You know, I've got one of these flat noses anyways. But I'm scraped up all the way. Somehow I come to my senses. I try to shake that off. And my neighbor, next door neighbor's, right, he was a professor at the university. And he and his wife were in the front yard saying, he's killed two people. I know there's two people he murdered. He's telling that. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what, I'm trying to remember all this shit. I don't remember any of that happened. I said, I haven't killed anybody. He said, we need to go into the house. So we go into the house. And the cops come up, they follow me into the house. He says, where's the gun? I said, well, I've got a gun, and I got a shotgun, and it's here. And he said, well, we're going to have to take the shotgun. I said, well, it's fine with me. And as we walk through the house, because he said, I want to see these other guys. Well, they're still back there in the back drinking and taking care of the other things that they didn't want anybody to see. You know, because obviously when you got cops walking in, there's certain shit you don't want them to see. You know, and the alcohol's okay, but, you know, this other stuff that we don't talk about in AA is there, and we don't want them to see it. So they were obviously taking care of business there. And we go in, and I say, you see, they're both alive. Everything's cool with them. They're drunk, too. And then bottom line is I ended up telling these cops, because they walked in and they just could not believe that I shot up my own house. They said, man, you shot your TV, you shot your stereo, you shot. And I remember looking at them and said, man, it's my house. What are you worried about, you know? And they said, well, we're going to have to take the gun, but I hadn't violated anything. See what I mean? Nobody could prove, other than there were spent shotgun shells all around. I didn't really just fire them any outside. So one cop says, well, there's really nothing we could take him in on. You know, he discharged a firearm in his own house and he shot his own shit up. But we're gonna give him a pass, but we're going to take the gun. And that's when I explained to him that the party was really going to happen the next night. And that's what was going on. So he said, this isn't the real party. I said, no, the real party's tomorrow night. Now, guess what? The next day, you know, and I had to really get some people in to get things straightened out before that party happened. And I did. But there were police cars parked down the street all over because they figured, hell, I'm not going to party that way. One more thing about the part of my life and part of my story and what I did when I was drinking, though, is that I went to Vegas one time with three guys, and I always end up partying with people. You know, I loved being around people and partying with them and doing all kinds of crazy things. And I talked to Vince, these guys, and then let's go into Vegas. And I said, let's, instead of driving, let's just take a flight over to Las Vegas and we'll finish out the evening there, because we're going to be able to drink all night and have a good time. And so we go down in his van. There was a van. We drove down to LAX, and evidently there were no more flights going to Vegas by the time we got there. They did have a flight going to Honolulu. And so these two guys that were with me, they didn't want to continue the party, I guess. And so I'm drunk enough to where, this based on what they told me, is we told you that we weren't going, and you just had to buy a ticket to Honolulu. So I ended up the very next morning flying out on a red eye to Honolulu, last flight out. Sun's just coming up over Oahu in Honolulu International Airport. And I asked the guy next to me, we're going. Is that around you guys? Where are we going? And he says, we're about 15 minutes out of Honolulu, Hawaii. So I ended up landing in Hawaii and spending 3 days there and don't remember a whole lot there. Came back. But that was the story of my life, was always getting drunk up until December 17th of 1980. And I took my last drink, and if you start doing the math, because she said Dan had 38 years. Well, 1980 is a little later than 38 years. You have a little more time without a drink or any other mind-altering chemicals except for one. And one they write prescriptions for, and it's legal. And because of AA, and I respect AA, and I'm an alcoholic, I'm not going to talk about that, but I ended up readjusting my date to April 10th, 1985. And a guy told me at one time that I was working with, he said, you didn't do that just because that's the day the big book was printed. Because if you notice it, it's printed, first edition was printed on April 10th, but 1985, 1939. But he thought it was kind of synchronistic that I would have that date and that he thought I'd planned it out. I said, no, I didn't. I didn't plan it out that way. But I started to live a life beyond my wildest dreams when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if anybody's in these rooms and they wonder if they're in the right place, well, if people have been like me that were telling me long before I quit drinking that maybe I had a problem with drinking, I had guys that were drinkers telling me that maybe I had a problem with drinking. And if you've got people like that telling you that, you might have a problem with drinking. So I ended up here in Alcoholics Anonymous and on April 10th of 1985, but in 85 I came clean and I had a bunch of time. People were really thinking I was sober, and I remember coming back and going to my home group and having to share that I couldn't cop to that anymore. I couldn't use the December 17th number anymore, but I never forget those numbers, because I'll tell you why I quit drinking. It's nothing that I did. That power was involved with me from the first drink to the last drink. That same power that holds us together, that we do those steps, was with me. And I think that power knew exactly what I needed, and I don't regret 1 ounce of alcohol I ever drank. Well, there's some people that do, but I don't. Because alcohol saved my life. Because if it weren't for alcohol, I would have probably killed myself. My first suicide attempt was at 9. But many times I thought about killing myself stone cold sober. So when I start talking about how I readjusted dates, is I knew exactly what I needed. And so I work with a few guys that go through that same experience that I had. And I always tell them, you can wait 4 or 5 years and then readjust, or you can do it now before it's too late, before you have to feel like I felt. But I'm glad, and I look at that experience, and I don't ever put them down because they want to do that. I don't think anybody, that's not my place. We're alcoholics. We're Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not my place to tell somebody not to do something. It's to share my own experience with whatever that problem is. And that's the only thing I do, is share my own experience with it. And I was told early on in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that it's no mind-altering chemicals whatsoever. So, for me, AA, I would have never made it to AA, and that's why I say that alcohol, my Uncle Henry, all those experiences, the bowling alley, all of that, this all comes from one place, that same place that helped us write this book. helped us write these steps, the same one that got me here then, because I would have not even known God. And I don't know if anybody's got any problems with this power greater than yourself in the rooms, but I had a big problem with it coming into the rooms. And I'll tell you, right now, that power, he never had a problem with me. I was the one that had the problem. But now I come to realize that he knew exactly what I needed and he let me do it. And in that very moment, on December 17th of 1980, if I'd have known that that was going to be the day, I would have drank even more. But that power was there on April 10th, you know. Actually, on April 9th. If I'd have known that that was going to be the day, I would have probably smoked some more. But I didn't. I think that power was involved. And then many, many years later, trials and tribulations with business and creating this wonderful experience that I call Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the fact is, when I got to AA, my first sponsor took me out in the parking lot. He said, "Close your eyes, Dan, and picture your life the way you would like it to be." And every time I meet with a guy, I always say the same thing. Close your eyes. Think about the way you'd like your life to be. Dream it. Whatever it is. And keep your eyes closed until you can see it. And then I finally, after a long period of time, he said, "Can you see it? Can you see it?" And I said, "I can see it." He said, "Open your eyes." And he said, "Dan, it's going to be better than that. It's going to be better than that. If you just stick to this program, do the 12 steps to the best of your ability, you're going to have a life beyond your wildest dreams." And I've got to tell you, I do. I have a life way beyond my wildest dreams. My beautiful wife, Mary Kay, came with me. That's another one right there. And I'm really grateful to her. And that's another one where you don't listen. I don't ever tell guys not to get involved in the first year. You know, because that doesn't work. That doesn't work. But I got to tell them, right? I've got to tell them, hey, especially you don't do that. But I didn't listen. But my wife and I have been together over 40 years. You know, 40 years, and we met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sitting next to my wife is my son. He celebrated 20 years. And up standing in the corner is my daughter-in-law, Alexis. And she's carrying little Tony with her right now, and he's going to be here in June. I'm really looking forward to that. And that is the life beyond my wildest dreams, is that my son can be sober. He probably would have never met Alexis had he not been sober. He wouldn't have the life that he has. My wife and I, we have a wonderful life together, and it's not been easy, but it's a great life. The first step tells me, and the reason why I asked for the steps to look at, it says, we admitted that we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become manageable. I have to admit that I'm powerless. The we part of it, I got to change it to me. I have to admit. And then I have to admit to myself, am I powerless over just alcohol? What else am I powerless over? I'm powerless over the way people treat me. I'm powerless over what happens with clients and business. I'm powerless over people I interact with. I'm not God. And that's for the first beginning. And how do I know that that's the problem? Is it says right here when it... my life has become unmanageable. So anytime my life is unmanageable, it's me. It's not them. It's not the job. It's not the person. It's me. Taking the power back because I want to play God. I want to know what's better. And then so it says in the second step, came to believe the power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. Well, that says in the second step, if you come to believe in a power greater than yourself, that assumes, it talks about being restored to sanity, that I'm crazy. Right? Would assume if I'm going to be restored to sanity, that I've got to be crazy. So in that second step, it's really important for me to understand that. Third step is really made a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God as I understood Him. And that was a really tough one for me. Completely turning my will and my life over the care of God. Because that means I've got to turn everything over.
not just the alcohol, because I think a lot of the guys that I've worked with, it wasn't the alcohol that took them out. It was some relationship they got into, some job they lost, some situation that was out of their control, and they took the power back. So it says, and they went insane. Because it says, restore me to sanity, made a decision to turn my will and my life. Now, what's my will? My will is right here, my thinking. You know, because somebody cuts me off on the road, I'm going to let them know. So that's will. I'm going to enforce my will on somebody. And then it says, my life. What's my life? It's the actions when I say, you know, that guy gets a pass. You know, I'm not going to get all upset about that. I'm not going to get upset just because somebody was a little rude to me. I'm not going to get so upset that I'm going to get blow up and ruin my day over it. So that third step is real important to me because of the fact that I had to learn that my will is my thoughts, my life is my action. And my actions tell me how much sanity I've got. I don't know anybody here sober has done some crazy ass shit. Because I have. I mean, literally crazy stuff. On a regular, on the reg. Doesn't just happen, you know, every now and then. But it's been on the regular, and I have to just go to God and say, hey, you know what? I need to be restored again because I'm going crazy over here. My life's unmanageable by this person, place, or thing. So then I get right back into made a searching and fearless moral inventory, number four. And I don't know where I'm at on time, so the secretary's going to have to let me know. But I love going through these steps because the fearless and moral inventory, what am I doing there when I do this inventory? So I write down everything in my life. What ideally, what I'm looking for is my own defects in that inventory. I need to discover what I did to people, you know, the things I did, the people I resent, and the things they did to me to see why. And to expose my character defects. Not theirs. Because there's nothing. That takes me back to step one again. If I think I can control people, places, and things, then I got the power, and I think I'm God. And that's not the case. I haven't been that for a long time. At least this morning I thought of this. You can ask my wife. You know, admitted to God and ourselves and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I've got to take that. I've got to take that to somebody. It's not real complicated. And if you do the first three steps really well, I mean, you really get to that full surrender, and I say that first step. I spend a lot of time on the first step when I work with guys because I think it's so important to get to that poor, powerless state. How much power do you really think you have? You know? But it says, I've got to take this to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Well, what are the exact natures of the wrong? It goes back to character defects again. You know? I've got some character defects, and they've been playing themselves out way before I took a first drink. Way after I quit drinking. I did a sober inventory at 13 years ago that was probably the best inventory I ever wrote. Because I never looked at my own defects. And it says, humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings. You know, humbly ask this power to remove them. Because I'm not capable of removing them. I always love somebody to say, well, I'm working on my character defects. I have to look at them and say, man, good luck. I've never been able to do anything. But if you can tell me how you do it, I'd be more than happy to listen. But it says here, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. So it said, made a list of all persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. You know, I got to make amends to not just my wife, my son, my daughter, my friends, all the people that I screwed up. I remember when I went over and met one guy, when I wrote a card, and I wrote down all the things that I'd done to him that I felt really bad about and that I needed to make it right and I needed to find out by it. And I remember him looking at it and he said, he saw me because I had this card. I didn't want to forget anything. You know, and I looked at that card and I said, you know, I want to try to make this right. And he said, is there anything that I've left out that you should let me know? And he looked at me and he said, you need a lot more cards. Because he said, Dan, you were an asshole before you drank. He said, I've known you ever since you were a little kid. He said, you're an asshole then. And he said, you've been treating people that way your whole life. And I thought to myself, you know what, he was right. And he actually gave me some names of some other people. I thought it was done. You know, but he said, hey, this guy, this is what you did. This guy, this is what you did. This guy, this is what you did. You know? So what did he do? Help me to reveal my character defects. Those are the things that I need to get rid of. These are the things I need a power to get rid of. And it says, made direct amends. Well, that's pretty easy. That's what I was doing. And sometimes you're going to get some more amends based on the amends that you're making. But the main important thing is to be able to, for me, it's not, the amend isn't just for me. It's for the other person too. And that's why I ask him, is there anything that I left out? Or is there anything that I may have done that he didn't talk about? And how did this make you feel? And I'll tell you what, there's some powerful, powerful healing experiences that come from the other side. So, and if you haven't done these steps, and I will say this, is that I've worked with hundreds of guys over the years that I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can tell you of only about 5 or 6 guys have ever finished their amends. 5 or 6. And you'll know if you guys go to a big book study, we get to that part where we start reading about amends, you don't see anybody raising their hand and say, you know, I've completed all my amends. You know, they just don't. So when a guy gets through it, I've got one guy that's got one left, 2 of them, that comes to our Tuesday night meeting that are close. And I mean, it's important to them, it's important to our group that they have completed their amends. But it's one that's overlooked because they say, made this right or made that right. And then continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Again, looking at what character defects do I still have that I haven't gotten rid of? Sought through prayer and meditation, improve my conscious contact with this power and the power to carry it out. And as I understood him, praying only for his knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. You know, and that's pretty sums it up, is I've got to be, when do I have to be connected to this power? Right now. When I come to this meeting, when I get up in the morning, when I go home tonight, when I have to be asked that power throughout the day. It's right now. It's not next week, it's not tomorrow, it's right now in this meeting. So, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Well, the principles are right here. And also in that first 164 pages of the big book in the doctor's opinion. If you want to learn the principles, you want a life beyond your wildest dreams, go to a book study and start learning it and taking the steps. Find a sponsor that isn't easy that'll help you work with them. And work through it and pull some of the stuff out of you. Because it doesn't happen just by talking about it. I mean, you got to get into it and do some work. The book talks about that. I think we're there, aren't we?
About that.
So I do appreciate it. And I guess that this is the time for the second part, or what? Will
you
ask some questions? Or?
All right, guys, our speaker has graciously agreed to entertain a few questions. Let's focus on any questions on how the speaker's experience might enhance our recovery, and we'll limit those questions to 10 minutes. So, go ahead. Anybody have any questions for our speaker?
How many sponsors do you have?
I don't really talk about how many, but there's right now probably guys, and I always tell them I'm really more of a step guide than a sponsor because those guys help me stay sober.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's always an honor when I'm asked. But there's quite a few. Let's say between 5 and 10. On a pretty much regular basis, I'm meeting with guys going through steps. And the thing about it is when they go through the step, I go through the step.
Right.
See, I get to go over it over and over again. So, yeah. And as far as sponsorship, start doing it right away. You know, Bill Wilson, I'm going to bring this up. You know, he failed almost 100 times before he met Dr. Bob. Guess if he'd have given up at 89 or 90, we wouldn't be here tonight. So I encourage new guys to come and say, hey, give your card up. Reach out. Help that newcomer. You know, spend some time with them, talk to them, and get them through it. Well, I haven't done all my steps. Well, you know, if that Bill Wilson would have said that, he'd have been in trouble too because he didn't have 12 steps. But he knew that it worked. One alcoholic talking to another helps. So, thank you.
How do you build a strong relationship with your higher power?
That's, you know, for me, on 86, in the big book, there's a page, it starts on 86, and a lot of guys that haven't gone through the steps, they say, well, Dan, why would you take guys for that far into the book if they haven't done it all? But I start with meditation first. The 3 minutes you guys do here, that's amazing. You know, there's very few meetings I go to where they do set aside time. But try to set aside some time to meditate, to get out of it. Because remember I talked to you about the my will and my life, it's my actions. My will starts up here. And I don't know about you, but I spend some time in quiet time every morning. I do 5 minutes every day. And what I do is try to clear the mind and I go into the body. Because one thing that will slow down the mind is getting into the body. Now, what does this have to do with God? Everything. Because God is within every part of us, within our brain, in our body, in our experiences. So, page 86 says, upon awakening, things that I do. And also on that page it says the evening review. But depending on how far along you are in the steps, but I like to get guys meditating right away, immediately. When I start to work with a guy, first thing I teach is we're going to go and we're going to meditate. And we start with your foot. Just start thinking about your right or left foot. Wherever you start, I start thinking about my toes. I thank God for my toes. I'm glad I can move them. I thank God for my ankle. I thank God for my calf. And I let that energy, and I feel that energy, and I realize that's God's energy right there with me. And then I go right into the knee and let it swirl around the knee and up the thigh. And then I go into each individual figure because I ask you to be anchored. I want you to be anchored when you do that. And I move through my entire body, recognizing each body part up to my ear, to my hair, to my eyebrows, to my cheeks. And then I go down the other side the same way to the other foot. It takes about 5 minutes for me, but it gets me really close and clear to God. And then I say my prayer to Him. And I use the third step prayer every day. And I think it's a good prayer to just practice. And it's one. But then I add a little bit to it because I remember discovering some of the defects that I did from the evening before. And I say, I need some help with this. Because if it's something that you haven't been able to break, I don't care what it is, His power can help you out with it. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Richard Alcala.
Hey, Richard.
Besides sponsor, that's breath. And then maybe do you do something that you don't want to do each day?
So let me rephrase that. You want to know, besides sponsorship, is there something that I don't want to do every day that I do because I know it's the right thing? That's another great question. You know? Right. A lot of times I don't want to do what he just suggested. I don't want to take the time to get close to God. You know? I don't want to take that time. I want to do what I want to do. The first thing, I don't know about you guys, but the first thing I wake up with is I'm thinking about Dan. You know? I'm not thinking about anybody else. But you're absolutely right. The other thing I do that's really, and I encourage my guys to do it, is that when they see a newcomer, to go ahead and extend a hand to them and ask them, And I try to get them to all get pre-printed cards made up just with their name. They don't have to have a business card unless they have a business. But if they have a business, hand them the card. And I always tell them, don't give it to them and say, and this is something I didn't want to do in the beginning, so I will tell you that, is that I give them the card and I say, will you call me and help me stay sober? And they usually stop and look at you like, what? And then they say, yeah, sure. And then I follow it up with, when? When will you call me? And they go, when would you like to call me? And I say, can you call me tomorrow? They say, yeah, I'll call you tomorrow. And I'm going to tell you something about that, is 1 out of 10 will call you. But you have a much better odds. I don't know how many people are in this room that have given your phone number out to somebody and never heard from them. Because what kind of, when you casually give, hey, call me before you take a drink. I mean, that's real exciting. You know? That really makes you sound like you really want to work with this guy. But when you give it to him and say, will you help me stay sober? Because that's what he's going to do. He's going to help me stay sober. The book tells me that. So I give him the card, ask him when, and only 1 out of 10 will call me. 1 out of 10 will begin the work.
That's right.
1 out of 10 will finish the work.
Amen.
So you're going through a lot of 1 out of 10s. And so some of them, but you got to go through a shit ton of people. But there's what's really great about it is there's a lot of people coming into the rooms.
Yes.
So you're not going to have any shortage, especially after holidays. Yes?
I'm an alcoholic. I've got 2 questions. 1, did you ever get the shotgun back? And 2, what was it like when you first came into the room, something that attracted you that gave you hope that it was going to work? Right? Early in your sobriety.
2 questions. Did I ever get the shotgun back? And what did I do early in my sobriety that made me feel like it was going to work?
What was it? Something that...
What it was is, and I will tell you the first thought one, I'll answer the first one first. Yes, I got the shotgun back. They released it to me. They gave it back to me, and I... later on, my wife didn't want me to have any guns in the house. So I ended up getting rid of all the guns anyways. But the second thing was, when I went into Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that I really thought would work is that I went to a speaker meeting and the guy had a lot of time, but he shared my story. He shared a lot of my own experiences, and I didn't believe that he was telling the truth, but it gave me hope. And the guy that I went up to after the meeting, he took a 30-day chip. That's the guy I went up and talked to. I went up and talked to that guy and I asked him, because I saw him get a 30-day chip, and I said, how did you do it? And he told me, he said, I got a big book, I've got a sponsor, I'm working the steps, and I'm going to meetings. And he wasn't drinking. And I thought, man, maybe I can do that for 30 days, you know. So it really changed my life. The other thing that really changed my life was the first man-on-man hug I ever got in my life. It was a guy I met at the Alano Club that took me to that speaker meeting. He welcomed me home. He said, you're home. You know, and for some reason, you know, I had never had a guy hug me like that before. He just hugged me and said, welcome home. And I've been home ever since. This is home, no matter where I'm at. So. Any other questions?
Well, it's not a question. I just want to say, man, you're awesome. Wow. You're a lot of good stuff.
Well, thank you. Yes.
What's the best way to take care of nutgrass?
There's a product called Manage or Sedgehammer. Yeah. Sedgehammer and Manage. And always treat it when it's at the 3-leaflet state.
Your story's inspiring, by the way.
So, and use the surfactant, which is the sticky stuff. When you go to buy it, tell them I need a surfactant. It's the sticky stuff.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we're out of time for questions, so we will now open up the discussion part of our meeting. Let me give this back to the Dan so he can pick some people to share. These are in-person attendees and these are online. And these are people to
share. Okay,
I will pick, how about Bill H.,
and
how he just celebrated on the
11th. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Dan, thanks. I'm Al Paul, Mr. Hoffman. Dan, thanks for coming. I'm sure that we didn't meet like my first, probably not even my first year, but I've known you for a long time. And tonight, again, you've reminded me why I've made a point of staying in contact with you, because the things that you say are things that I've felt. Mm. And I've experienced now. On Tuesday, I celebrated 18 years of sobriety. And, you know, Dan talked about I'm going to put maybe some different words to it, but he talked about the disease of addiction or alcoholism as being a progressive thing, and that, you know, clearly I didn't get in a lot of trouble the first time I drank. In fact, that was probably one of the biggest problems, is I didn't get into trouble early on, and so I thought I was like bulletproof, you know. Mm-hmm. And then over the years, you know, things began to get worse, but I just couldn't see the relationship between the trouble and the alcohol. I mean, it was obvious to anyone with half a brain cell, right? But I couldn't see it. It was just bad luck, circumstances, you know, people out to get me. It could never possibly be, you know, the decisions I was making, the things I was doing. When I did eventually entertain the idea of living sober, I too had experiences, it sounds like that you had. And one of the things that I did was I went and I thought it'd be clever to take over-the-counter medications to catch a buzz, because that wouldn't count, I thought. And to me today, anything that changes the way I feel counts, right? There's no freebies. Well, actually, the freebies when you wake up in the morning and you were having a dream, you were out putting on a good one, and it takes till noon to figure out that, you know, you're still sober. You guys have never had that happen. But the other thing, and you talked about it, is that, you know, the disease isn't the only thing that's progressive. That recovery is progressive. And like you described, my life has changed in ways that I couldn't have anticipated. You talked about being asked to close your eyes and imagine what your life might be, and then told, hey, check it out. That ain't even close. It's going to be so much better. And you know, I never in my life thought it would be possible to be in a marriage type relationship. It ain't my bag, man. It ain't gonna. Other people can only take so much of me for so long, you know. And you know, earlier this year, my wife and I celebrated 14 years of marriage. And there's people been married longer, and people been married shorter. And for some people, marriage ain't a gig. That's cool. But I will say that not only can I say that I'm happy about being in that relationship, I know in my core that my wife is also happy about being in that relationship. And that's something that in my experience, you can only experience. You can't tell me what it's like to be in a relationship with somebody who wants to be in a relationship with you. But if you're in a relationship with someone who wants to be in a relationship with you, then you'll know it.
Right.
And that's the same thing that happens in this process of recovery that we go through with these 12 steps. And man, I just find myself. I have a great deal of affection for people who have had a similar experience. Mm. And I think a big part of that is that it validates that I'm not just imagining that my life is changing, that in fact, if you can describe how your life has changed, and there are mirror examples in my own life, then maybe, just maybe, this is real, and this isn't just some fantasy. Mm. And my life has changed. And guess what? I'm not the guy that walked in here over 18 years ago. Amen. I'm not even that person at all.
Amen.
And last night we had a big event right here in this room, and most every... Who wasn't here? Okay, don't cry because you missed it.
Because you did this.
It was a great time. And it was a room packed full of people that I just have a similar affection for. So thanks for being here tonight, Dan. Congratulations on...
Yeah, let's call on your wife.
Mary Kay.
You're up.
What?
For sharing.
Oh, for sharing. Okay. I remember the day I met Dan. I believe it was my first meeting. I don't remember if it was your first meeting. But I saw you across a crowded room, and I thought, what a loudmouth asshole. But I guess that's what I'm attracted to. We've had our ups and downs, but, you know, we've always maintained this appreciation for finding another soul that you can really, you know, just feel... tenderness, because you understand them and they're willing to give you part of them, and you're kind of willing. It's a long process, though, to be willing to give to somebody. For at least for me as an alcoholic, it was very difficult. But my moment of truth was maybe a day before I met him. And I was in my apartment on Dracaena. I had a broken back, a broken leg, an auto accident, and I was on crutches with a pockets full of change, crutching my way down to the Locust liquor store to buy whatever that would buy. And I remember one night I got home, and I laid on this mattress on the floor, no sheets, nothing on there. And I was sweating like a dog, and I just screamed out, God, help me! Do something! And I turned to look on the floor, and there was the big book, and I went, oh, fuck! And so I picked it up. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, what else can I do at 3 o'clock in the morning? So I read the book from cover to cover. I didn't understand a thing I read, but it somehow grabbed me. It was like, a life force. And so the next morning I called the Milano Club, asked when their meeting was, and I believe I walked 10 miles to that first meeting. You know, it was just like, and then I got there and I sat down, and there he was. And it was like, okay. I just remember looking across the room at him like, what the heck? You know, I mean, he was bigger than life, okay? And then he introduced himself, and what was really strange is that we had met before, and he was 9 years old, and I was 18, and he lived down the street from my grandmother. And so I was going up to my grandmother's. I had my Garcia's uniform on. I was a kid. And he comes up to me, and he's on his little bike, and he goes, hi, I'm Dan. Guess where I'm going? And I said, well, where are you going? He goes, I'm going to ride my bike over the ridge route. And I thought, okay. And I, you know, he said, nice meeting you. And he left, and I went home, and I remember telling my parents what a strange little kid. And I guess he went home and told his friend that he just met the woman he was going to marry. So this was like many, many years later that we came upon each other, and that was the first miracle. Well, the first miracle was the AA book. that was God-given.
Amen.
You know, it really was. And it makes me realize that whatever, you know, person, whether it's God or your guardian angel or the person who's protecting you within yourself, really cares what happens to you. Really cares, but doesn't interfere. You know, never interferes. Lets you do your thing, but it's always there when you're ready.
Right.
Mm. Always there. And it's tough. He doesn't say, oh, here, just read the book and I'll carry you to the AED. He says, read the book and get on your feet and walk it. He says, you know, you've got to do some hard work here. And that's what it was. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. You know, absolutely. And then I had my children. And my daughter-in-law, and a baby on the way, and a daughter who's an artist, and who has a husband who's wonderful. It doesn't get any better. It just doesn't get any better. All I had to do was quit drinking. That's all I've got.
Thank you, Matt.
You want to take something?
Does anybody feel the need to share? We've got like about a minute and a half left.
My name's Josh, an alcoholic.
Josh.
And Dan's my grand sponsor. And to get current, I was sober for 3 years, and I had a profound spiritual experience to start my sobriety. And I rested on my laurels. I was trying to help people. I like spiritually sponsored people for a long time, and I kind of went through the steps, but I half measured it. And I just kept on, I was still like kind of searching, but I just rested on that spiritual experience that I had. And I finally figured out when I was taking a guy through the steps, when I was going through the fourth step with another guy, that I wasn't very clear. I couldn't really, it wasn't clicking. And then I finally had to fire my sponsor, which is hard. And I blamed my sponsor because I expected him to do the work for me. And I picked up another sponsor. I would say he picked up me, and his name's Kevin, OG surfer from Ventura, hardcore, you know what I'm saying? We're up here, on the way up here, he saw tell me war stories about Hells Angels, and I was telling my war stories about Los Angeles. Like, you should be dead. People you hung out with, you should be dead. By the grace of God, I'm here. But the way Dan took Kevin through the steps at 33 years sober, the way Kevin took me through the steps, I just didn't take guys through the steps. I do 3 minutes of meditation in the morning. I pray, but more than anything, I'm doing the work as suggested, and guys are staying sober. Mm-hmm. If you guys are sober, and you guys are struggling, and you guys are wondering, can I stay sober? You guys, I promise you, with this guy who was on Skid Row and the Tenderloin and an ex-heroin addict and a low-bottom drunk, you can one day at a time. Just know that it's a program of action, and you've got to take action. This is not a program for people who want it. It's not a program for people who need it. It's a program for people who do it. And Dan's the man. He knows he's the man, but he's very humble with that. And thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, but I love you.
All right, guys, let's give Dan another big hand.